Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight into how it affects our national deterrence. We hope you enjoy this show.
Welcome back to another great episode of the NIDS View. Of course, I'm Adam Lowther, along with Alex Littlefield and Kurt Fancher. Jim Petrosky and Curtis McGiffin are out this week. They are TDY at Barksdale Air Force Base, teaching in one of the courses down there. So they'll be back next week. But for this week, I'm joined by Alex and Kirk. And like every week, we've got a great topic to discuss. So for this week, there have been significant discussions as of late about the credibility of the United States as an ally partner and as the provider of extended deterrence, both to NATO, particularly in regard to the significant threats that Russia has made since the beginning of the Ukraine war. And then, of course, there is, the Washington Declaration that came out about a year ago after President Yoon of South Korea said we may need to build our own nukes. And, you know, we've had that Washington Declaration in which the United States has been ramping up extended deterrence assurance efforts. And it's been working, it seems. And, of course, Japan is worried. And they're worried because of China's nuclear breakout. They're worried because Kim Jong-un has said North Korea is going to build a nuclear arsenal of 500 weapons that range from, you know, a complete triad of bombers, submarines, and ICBMs, and then, of course, tactical nuclear weapons. And so we have a strategic environment that has a lot of people worried. And our allies are saying, hey, is the U.S. still credible? And so before we do that, I wanted to, you know, as we discuss this topic, I wanted to turn it over to you, Kirk, because really the most pressing issue right now is NATO. And that's, you know, that's sort of your area of focus is NATO. So let me turn it over to you for, you know, some discussion about the perception of American credibility.
Yeah, I think regardless of who's talking, Trump, Obama, Biden, whomever, we go through cycles where our allies feel more or less assured by our extended deterrence umbrella. Going back to the days of Reagan, when as part of arms reduction, we pulled Glickham and Pershing and other NATO-based nuclear forces out of NATO. Now we have a number of conversations that are get in the news that are being had within NATO, everything from Poland wanting to participate with dual capable aircraft as part of burden sharing, to the French talking about becoming a more active extended deterrent provider to the rest of NATO. And to the British conversations about do they need to double their submarine force so they can have two boats at seas, and what about reconstituting their triad? They used to have a triad, especially as they get rid of Tornados. They're lacking in a bomber capability, and they no longer have a missile capability. So there's a broad conversation within NATO about, is American extended deterrence enough? Do we have the capacity? Do we have the focus given other things happening in the world that can distract us from NATO? Ukraine, the balancing between supporting Ukraine and Israel is generating some of that conversation. The German people have started talking about, does Germany need to have nuclear weapons of their own? And that that conversation has changed in tone and in the how it's received by the German people. And there was a great Peter Husey event that talked to that in great detail just last week or so. So there is a broad conversation across NATO. NATO is starting also to focus on China. There's talk of NATO opening a coordination office in Tokyo with the Japanese, working more closely with the Koreans, because I think NATO's starting to understand that maybe the threat isn't Russia acting alone, but acting in concert with something happening in China. With the addition of Finland and Sweden and other conversations happening in NATO, the impetus of Ukraine, NATO is really going through a period of introspection across a lot of fronts, and nuclear deterrence is a big part of that conversation.
Now, as we also think about our, you know, bilateral allies in South Korea and Japan, there's significant concern about North Korea and China. So I wanted to turn it over to you, Alex. Tell us a little bit about how you see the dynamic working in Asia in regard to American, you know, credibility and extended deterrence in the region.
Going back to Kirk's reference to the Husey event about a week ago with Max Holler on NATO, and one of the questions is, to what extent do the Europeans even see China as a threat? Or is it just they perceive Russia as a threat? And to the extent that the Europeans want to align themselves with the Americans, our problem with China becomes a European problem. But to the extent that the Europeans believe they can take a separate path outside of the U.S. umbrella of security, they then tend to be more Eurocentric, focusing just on the Russians. But with regards to our extended deterrence and the signals we're giving, if you just look at what's happening at the second Thomas Shoal with our ally, the Philippines, we have a mutual defense treaty with Philippines since the 1950s, and all the attacks that have been happening on their boats as they restock the Sierra Madre, the boat they put out there on the second Thomas Shoal. We keep telling the Chinese, you know, it's even Mike Gallagher and Biden, high-level people who from government, saying, you know, if China continues to do this, there'll be a price to pay. And lo and behold, China still continues to harass our ally, Philippines, and we've done nothing about it other than writing statements and saying something will happen. But I wouldn't find that very reassuring to the Philippines or to any of our allies in Europe or elsewhere, that we would actually be willing to stand by and help them, since we have an ally being harassed and we're not doing much about it.
I guess one of the things I wonder is, let's take Europe first. So between the Brits and the French, they have roughly 500 nuclear weapons. And then the United States has fewer than 200 that are, you know, fighter-delivered gravity bombs. So our contribution to the extended deterrence in Europe is rather limited. I mean, in 1991, when the Cold War ended and the Soviet Union collapsed, there were more than 5,000 U.S. nuclear weapons in Europe. Now it's fewer than 200 gravity bombs. So I wonder how important is it? Because even without the U.S., you know, B-61-12 in Europe, Europe's still a nuclear alliance. And so is it really important? That's sort of for you, Kirk. And then for you, Alex, if you think about both South Korea and Japan, we have no nuclear weapons in either country. Now, we very clearly had nuclear weapons in South Korea during the Cold War. And then we pulled those out at the end of the Cold War, about the same time we pulled them out of Europe. And so for those two countries, they depend upon our submarine ballistic missiles on our, you know, ballistic missile submarines that are in their deep ocean boxes in the Pacific, is, you know, that's sort of the deterrent for China or North Korea. And I wonder, is that really an effective deterrent, to have them sort of at sea and underwater and invisible? And so I sort of pose that question to both of you in terms of how visible and important is what we actually provide.
I think it's important. It's important enough that when it's called into question, it creates a lot of conversation amongst our allies of how are we going to offset this potential lessening of U.S. commitment to extended deterrence. So from the, you know, from on the spectrum of deterrence, with the carrot side being assurance, and us trying to assure our NATO allies, we've obviously kicked the hornet's nest a little bit there, enough that they're wondering if their reductions as part of the peace dividend were a little bit misguided as well. Did they become too reliant on the U.S.? I think the other thing that's very complicating, especially if you talk about deterrence within the framework of escalation control, when we start saying, okay, yeah, we're going to have a low yield SSBN delivered warhead, that doesn't seem to me to be a real cost effective and certainly open to a lot of confusion and fear that we're going to respond to a low yield use with a missile off of a submarine. I mean, it shows where the submarine is. It's expensive to do it. You don't know if it's a big bomb or a little bomb or where it's going. So it's destabilizing in that regard. I think one of the best things we could do for extended deterrence in Europe is a combination of doing some more forward basing of our bombers. Exercise that flexible visibility would be really I think effective, and I think we need to be more aggressive in pursuing variants on LRSO like Slick-M-N that could be put on British cruisers and give them a vertical launch capability, could be put on attack submarines and increase the NATO organic capability at the lower end of the spectrum as a way of managing escalation control and keeping things from spiraling out of control, signaling more deterrent. So I'm a big fan of Slick-M-N.
Well, how about, you know, Glick-M and Pershing, you know, Pershing 3? Because if we go back to the lessons learned from INF, for us, what might be a tactical fight is a strategic fight for the Russians, because it's strategic attack against the Russian homeland that even a short range weapon would be capable of. For us, we can trade, you know, Bonn or Berlin or Paris for Moscow, St. Petersburg. We can do that any day. So therefore, the stakes are higher for the Russians than they are for us, which is why, you know, the Russians essentially capitulated and agreed to the INF treaty. They gave up far more than we did. And I wonder if we, in order to ramp down, you know, tensions in Europe, we might need to go back to that sort of formula that the Reagan administration had for pushing the Russians to negotiate away these capabilities and, sort of de-escalate in a way that we really can't with the capability we have in Russia or in Europe right now. Do you think that's something that we might need to do? Because I'm always skeptical of sea-based nuclear weapons.
As I said, I see Slicko Men as one of the variants of LRSO, and that LRSO can fill a lot of needs in those various variants. The sea-based version, if you put it on other NATO ships, that signals a version of commitment. It's easy to do because the vertical launch capabilities on a lot of these ships are already ELCOM capable, and we do have ground ELCOM capability for conventional ELCOMs in the Army. You know, I forget the name of their system. It's one step up from HIMARS. It's supposed to be capable of having an ELCOM type missile or missiles, two of them on a trailer. So I think the leveraging the work we're doing in LRSO and fielding it in multiple modalities to meet different needs, including the reconstitution of the UK triad with a ground launch variant and a sea launch variant, the ability to put it in countries that maybe don't have the F-35 or something like that. It being a mobile missile system, so it's more survivable. It maybe doesn't have to be forward based, but we could practice forward basing it. You know, if it's on a trailer and we can put it on a C-17 and fly it in and exercise it, then all of a sudden the Russians have to say, well, maybe it's not there, but maybe if we push our European allies hard enough, all of a sudden Germany and Italy and some of these places are willing to have that capability deployed forward to them. So I'm looking for flexibility in our options.
So for you, Alex, as you take a look at Asia and you think through how to most effectively deter both China and North Korea, how do you see it?
It's funny you say, how do you see it? Because on one of these Husey events, we had General Chun In Bum. He's a senior fellow with NIDS. And he suggested that we have U.S. tactical nuclear weapons on Korean soil, but they could call them South Korean. And he called it a two-key system so that there would be, he said you can have an American there next to the Korean before actually turning the key. But there probably needs to be something that's actually stationed back in Japan and South Korea, because we guaranteed them security already as far back as just after the San Francisco Treaty of San Francisco. And we've kept these countries, South Korea, Japan, and even Taiwan, from gaining their own nuclear capability. But in return, we haven't really done much to provide that defense that they had to give up. And while we did a great job of keeping our allies from having those defense weapons, we did nothing to stop North Korea and China and Pakistan and others to just keep working together to develop their capabilities. So we need to think carefully about changing our path that we have been taking and moving towards a position where these allies have more of their own capability on their own soil to defend themselves.
What do you think about Trump's comment I forget who he was doing an interview with, where he said, well, you know, if Pakistan and Saudi, he said, but in some of these other places are going to have nukes, he feels pretty comfortable with responsible countries like South Korea and Japan having their own nuclear forces, and, you know, even promoted the idea that they should go down that road, that they should be less reliant on the U.S. and more self-reliant, and that they've got the capacity to do it.
It's kind of like the metaphor of, like, gun control. If you ban guns, then only the bad guys will have guns, because all the good guys are going to follow the rules. And so we have here all the good guys basically follow the rules, didn't develop. And then in the meantime, all the the bad guys went gangbusters and just continue to push the envelope on their numbers and their delivery systems. So definitely it would be more of an extended deterrent if countries like South Korea and Japan and possibly even India, which could put pressure on China to some extent, if there was ever a contingency in the South China Sea, it would be good if some of these countries had more of their own capabilities. Because, too, if we are the ones who are going to be doing the shooting and pulling the trigger, it's something that was already brought up back in Cold War, was would we be willing to trade Washington for Paris or New York for Paris? And now, to fast forward to the present, would we be willing to trade New York for Seoul? And our allies don't believe we would. If North Korea hits Seoul, would we actually want to retaliate at the risk of losing a city like, you know, Los Angeles or something? So these countries need to have their own ability to defend their own people.
Alex, since you mentioned India, I think it's real interesting. This last week, India, I think their foreign minister was visiting Manila, and he basically said that, you know, China needs to knock it off. And then this comes right on the heels of the Indians testing an ICBM. It sounds like maybe India is gaining its footing as an emerging major power, and is starting to at least have a voice in some of these conversations, and not necessarily a voice that China was happy to hear.
Yeah, in the way that Ukraine is a big distraction to the United States in the event that there's a contingency in Taiwan, India could be a problem for China if China has to focus resources on a contingency in Taiwan. And now they have to worry about defending all their massive borders on the west and near India. So India could definitely create some grief for China. And just as China's been growing and improving and developing and all that good stuff in the last 30, 40 years, India has also not been sitting behind. It's also gone through a lot of its own economic development and is also a larger player on the world stage.
So I wonder, if we think about Asia in particular for a second, there's been this concern that can India, the Philippines, South Korea, Japan, Malaysia, Thailand, all of these, you know, countries that have either been neutral or lean towards the United States, can they effectively counterbalance China, Australia? Can they collectively counterbalance China? Or do they need the United States as a sort of a central player to make that happen, or can they do it on their own regionally? And as they've contemplated this, as we've discussed, and, you know, NIDS also has a, you know, a podcast in our NIDS knowledge series called Deterrence Down Under that comes out about once a month. That's a view from, you know, from Canberra. And the Australians have been wondering how relevant is American credibility and extended deterrence. And, you know, when the shooting starts, will the United States be there? And therefore, you know, Asian nations have to wonder, you know, will America be there? Will it not? And if it's not, or if it's there in a limited capacity, can we handle China on our own, China and North Korea? And then there's a similar question that's taking place in Europe, where you've got the Germans and the French and the British and the Poles, right? The Poles share a border, the Baltic states. Everybody's wondering, you know, if the United States were to step back, and most of it's premised on if Donald Trump is elected in November. That's sort of the general premise, is if he's elected in November, you know, will he pull out of Europe? Will he pull out of Asia? And can we handle Russia in Europe and China, North Korea in Asia? Can we handle them on our own?
Well, you don't,
Go ahead, Kurt.
You know, we're sort of in an anomalous era post-World War II. You know, United States has a pretty rich history of isolationism and really relying on our geographic position for safety, and the other powers around the world trying to have us be more involved. So that's obviously a concern. What I see, if I were sitting in another country, and I'm going to put my hat back on, when I was in Korea managing the war plan there, it was in the middle of when the whole thing was going on with the Korean nukes. And we got B-52s deployed to Guam. But at the same time, some of the forces that we were supposed to have committed to Korea were being committed in Bosnia. And I'm on the phone to the Pentagon, to the JCS, going, wait a second, how am I supposed to plan for, in this, during this heightened crisis, for my operations that I have to be able to do in Korea, when you're taking my allocated forces and using them elsewhere? And for me, that encapsulates the biggest concern for all of our allies. We are committed so broadly, and there are so many bad actors popping up. The odds of the United States being bogged down someplace and somebody trying to take advantage of it, and our allies having built their capability around our support, finding themselves a few players short in the game all of a sudden. That I think is a big part of what we have to address over the next 20 years, is how is the U.S. going to enable our allies and be there, but recognizing that the enemy's strategy is going to be to try and spread us thin.
Alex?
The U.S. really hasn't even done enough to protect itself, and now it's saying it's going to also protect all these extended allies. And one of the lessons, I'd say, of recent history is the countries who didn't fully trust us are actually in a better position now. So the Israelis, the Indians, and the French, they all went their own way in secretly or openly developing their nuclear capability. It was the ones who completely put themselves under our wings who are now suffering, who do not have the defenses they need. And we are just not in a place to say we're going to take care of everyone, because we can be hit and we can don't have a really good second strike or capability compared to everything the North Koreans and the Russians and the Chinese can throw at us.
Yeah, it's an interesting question, because, you know, one of the things that candidate Trump has said in the last month or so is, you know, he sort of was lambasted in the press for saying that he would let the Russians attack those countries that do not spend the 2%. That's sort of an agreement within NATO, and that he won't protect them. If you won't spend sufficiently, at least a minimum of 2% for yourself, then it's obviously not important to you. So I, President Trump, it's not going to be important to me either. That's sort of his logic. And, you know, there would be a lot of Americans who would say, yeah, if you won't spend money on yourself, why should we come to your rescue if things go south? And so it's not a crazy thing to say, but there's always the question is, what is the most effective way for the United States to maintain, you know, because in the end, it's all about maintaining American economic prosperity. That's, you know, militaries exist to deter war, to fight and win wars, but even more than that, they guarantee economic prosperity. And, you know, the Navy keeps the sea lanes of commerce open. You know, the Air Force keeps the air free for transit. And so as we think about what the United States military is doing, the U.S. military, historically, we would spend 5-7% of gross domestic product during the Cold War on the military. And then it declined to about 4% post 1991, and now we're hovering down around 3.5%. So we have also decreased defense dollars, just like the Europeans did, although we're still well ahead of our 2% requirement. So I wonder, as the United States in many respects follows a course similar to the Europeans, where the majority of spending is social and not defense or military, and those social programs crowd out defense dollars, which that's what happened in Europe, and it's what's happening in the United States. I mean, we're borrowing $1 trillion every 3 months. And so I just wonder, are we going to be able to build and maintain the kind of capability that is required to do what we've said we, you know, are treaty obligated to do in both Asia and in Europe?
If we don't, we're going to pay more in the long run if we don't. I hate the 2% benchmark. The smart countries are spending 4%. And Adam, a lot of what you talked about is, you know, we maybe spend 2%, and let's say that that's half our budget is committed basically to NATO. The other half our budget is committed to securing the global commons. And the way people have to look at it is through that economic lens that you put out there. The countries like India, like the United States, like the EU, that benefit the most from global trade have to be the people who are paying for that infrastructure. And that infrastructure in this case is maintenance of the global commons, including the sea lanes of trade. So, you know, the fact that India is standing up and doing, anti-piracy patrols off of the Middle East, off of the Straits of Hormuz and stuff like that, is another example of them recognizing that economically they benefit tremendously from the security of those areas. And it's maybe become too much to rely on the United States. So the economic powers have got to do what's in their best interest. And that means spending that 4% to enable their economies to thrive.
Yeah.
And regarding the sea lanes of communication, the U.S. actually sort of failed in that area, because if you look at the Red Sea, a lot of traffic had to go around the South Africa down there,
Cape Horn or Hope? I forget which.
Yeah,
one's which.
Cape, one of them, Cape Horn or the other. So we didn't really keep that area open. We allowed all the traffic to be rerouted. And we, that's something I think we have. I think we have the hardware to prevent that, but it also comes down to willpower, and willingness to do what it takes to keep things running smoothly.
Well, you know, back in my Navy War College days, we did a project, and actually we won a four-star award for it. And a big piece of that was focused on that. We looked at what sea lanes of control and what commerce routes benefit whom. Okay, so the oil in the Middle East has never been more than 12% of U.S. oil imports. We import oil from Venezuela. We import oil from Mexico. We import a lot of oil from the Western Horn of Africa. Now we're much more energy independent. But really where we were spending our dollars steaming U.S. vessels did not correlate well with where the trade routes that we benefited and used for. And you know, frankly, the Europeans were free riding. The Europeans, the Indians, and the Chinese are the ones that use Middle Eastern oil. They need to be keeping the sea lanes in the Indian Ocean safe. And oh, by the way, they happen to be the ones that are there. So it's a lot easier for them to do it. At one time, I was foolish enough to think that the Chinese need to step up, but that was when they were walking around wearing a white hat, pretending to be a good guy, so that, you know, they could do what they were doing behind closed doors. But I think the principle is still there. Nobody's going to do this alone.
So let me ask you as we close out the show, because we're out of time, is as you gaze into your crystal ball and look 5, 10, 15 years into the future, does the U.S. continue with the fullness of its treaty obligations in Europe? And that's for you, Kirk. That's it does or it doesn't. And for you, Alex, does it do that in Asia?
I think it does. I think there will be times and there will be different means of incentivizing the Europeans to do less free riding or cheap riding. We like to, the current administration likes to point to the fact that given the Ukraine war, all of a sudden the Europeans are stepping up and are spending more. But Trump's bombast had them committing to do that previously. And then when Biden won the election, they went, oh, okay, there's no longer a flame being held to our feet. We'll backwalk a little bit. And then Putin stepped in and gave them a different reason to do it. The question is, will the Europeans learn from that and say, we need to be dollar cost averaging and being consistent in what we're doing? Trump's comment about, people's comment about Trump leaving NATO, I don't think that'll ever happen. But I could very well see him putting the pressure on certain people, saying, "Hey, if you're not going to contribute, if you're not going to pay the price of admission, maybe we need to kick you out." Yeah. That's more where I would see playing that out.
We the United States won't base troops in your country. We won't exercise for your defense. Things like that. How about you, Alex? How do you see Asia?
5 years from now, we'll be doing what we usually do, which is we talk a big talk. But when it comes to actually what happens on the ground, there's not a lot to back up our talk. So what's happening right now with the Philippines being harassed by the Chinese Coast Guard, all we do is issue statements. We haven't actually done anything to prevent this. And even going back years when the tolls were being developed, we never did anything to stop them from being developed. We just allowed everything to move forward and to keep pretending nothing's happening when there's a lot of things that are going on that work against our interests and against our allies' interests. So 5 years from now, we'll still be doing that because that's what we've already been doing for the last 5 and more years.
All right. Well, Alex Littlefield, Kirk Fancher, thanks for joining us on this episode of the NIDS View. And of course, Jim and Curtis will be back next week. And we're going to talk, and I know many folks are going to be excited about this, and we're going to talk about Annie Jacobson's new book, Nuclear War, A Scenario. It's been a hot topic we've been discussing around the water cooler lately. And so we'll be talking about that. So make sure you tune in. So for you, the listeners, thanks for joining us on this episode of NIDS View. And always remember to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to the NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.